Blog Talk Radio.
This is a calling in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Wasn't this day revealed to us in the personality of His Imperial Majesty, Emperor Haile Selassie I? And daughters from afar, everyone that is called by my name, Rastafari, in the form of 500 families, to occupy 500 acres of land, to establish a model city to the world, in the land of Ethiopia. The Ethiopian World Federation was established in the United States of America by His Imperial Majesty Emperor Haile Selassie I. This is not a calling for the United States, it's a calling for all the children of the diaspora.
All right.
Live and live. Coming yes. to you live and live. Oh, okay. I was on mute, Dr. Robinson.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay, so this is Sadie Gomez of the Ethiopian Women's Federation Incorporated for Local 26 Woman Auxiliary coming to you live and live this Sunday evening. It's such a beautiful Sunday evening where we get together to talk, reason with some truth. Today, our subject matter, we want to discuss June 19th, our Juneteenth. It is indeed that holiday that was given to us. And many of us who are much younger have come to my observation that they are unaware of what Juneteenth really means and the significance of Juneteenth. This is kids 8 years old to about 14 that really ask the question, and they really are unaware. This we know, schools are not really teaching this subject or this event because it is part of our Black history, and I myself had to do the research into Juneteenth. So we are asking, what does this holiday mean to you? So for those of us who are listening, I want to weigh in our conversation later on. We are asking you to examine these points. So what I did see within the history of things, the holiday really did not go unnoticed, or the event, because Martin Luther King, he did show an interest into this holiday as to where it shall be celebrated, besides the fact that to mark this glorious day, June 19th, certain foods were even eaten. I imagine red food was used to celebrate this occasion. That's where we get the love of the watermelon, which later on come back to provoke us and try to degrade us. But we love the watermelon still. This was something that was used in the celebration at the various picnics. Also, red velvet cake was part of the recipe and the menu as well. And this would represent, these red foods, I was told, represent the blood that was shed by our people. So there's a lot of significance in the picnic and meaning of what happened concerning Juneteenth, where really such a wicked act was placed on us. Slavery itself, so devious, which just to survive, we see the resilience and strength of the black people, because here we are today, yet alive. But just to think, this horrid act has been over, and a few people, or quite a number of people, were not told, and continued along in this very same way. So this is some of the things we'd like to discuss today for Juneteenth, what it really means to you. Our other topic, which we'll go into, however, we are seeing a strong cases of the people who have taken vaccine. Now is the time we are already seeing and understanding the ramifications of such an act, whereby it is actually by law, or in a lot of hospitals, people who have taken the vaccine are not allowed to give blood. So this is a case where family members had gotten injured and some really good blood donors went to give blood. They were questioned. This is an actual event. The person in question wrote about it. And when they were questioned as to whether they had taken the vaccine, yes or no, and they were told, yes, they took it, they were not allowed to give blood. So this is another subject we would discuss on this wonderful Sunday evening for those in my listening audience. Dr. Robbins, you can tell me how the studio is looking. Dr. Robinson? Dr. Robinson, are we there? So my co-host is silent. I'm not able to see the studio board. For those who are listening in, I will have to have your mics unmuted before you can join in the conversation. But this is our subject matter for this evening. We are speaking of Juneteenth. We are wondering what it means to you and how you're going to go about teaching your children the meaning of this historical event, which cannot easily be erased or forgotten, an event that actually happened. And we would like for the children of this generation and their children and their grandchildren to know of this part of the history, very important and intricate part of the history that must be told, must be learned by the children, even though it's not taught in school or there's no great facts or excitement or place on it. There isn't even a movie, perhaps. And we know what happened the last time someone really, really tried to do Juneteenth. Because what Martin Luther King wanted, he wanted to commemorate this day by having a march around, I guess, the Oval Office, which would be called the Poor Man's March. This is what he was interested in having on this very day. And he was, in fact, assassinated 1 month after. So we know if there are people that would like to stand up, come forward and do something to commemorate this day, make it a grand holiday, do something grand, we'd like you to weigh in on your thoughts. Dr. Robinson, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay,
the board now is a little clear, you know, sometimes it's We're dealing with two holidays in one day, Father's Day and Juneteenth, which is going to be actually a federal holiday tomorrow. But in the meantime, between time, people are celebrating Father's Day, you know, and Juneteenth as well.
I so imagine, but I just wanted to really do the show on this day just to have it on the record. But I know there's a lot of people who are out of town busy since it's a wonderful, beautiful holiday. And we have to, I guess, have some music playing by the time until the board lights up.
Okay, you want to put on some music?
Well, is there anyone in the studio?
Okay, I'll put on some music here. Okay, let's see what we can get.
Yeah, I'm trying to get like two audience. But if not, you know, and then do we still have our text messages or something?
We have none at the moment. We'll just... how about going to a commercial break as well?
Okay, so that's a commercial break.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, entertainment worldwide network. We online. We in your speakers. And on your mind. On your mind. 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock. We on time. We on time.
Yes, this is Lenny Williams. I'm out here in Oakland, California.
I'm Lisa Wade. I sang on a payment with the NWA, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E.
It's Just Will, Black Pearl Entertainment artist, newly signed to I Am Jesus Records. You're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., CEO. Coming to you live, this is business, so pay attention.
Yo, it's your boy LV the Slap Fiend, and I'm over here chilling with my guy, The Plug, Don Jr., CEO, Entertainment Worldwide Network Radio. You dig?
What's good, homie? It's your boy, Big D.
It's your folk, Chuck and Traps.
This your peace, Captain Mac.
I let your boy, Boss Lena.
It's your boy, Brick Boy Rico.
It's your boy, Joe Dirt.
Hey, yo, what up? It's your boy, Buddha, a.k.a. Buddy Mouth.
Yo, what's good? It's the Vic Percy Jones.
And Big Cell is now in your area.
Yo, this your boy, Mr. Hamson.
It's your girl, Lady Duet.
It's just Rich Gates.
This your bro, JT, Mr. Guaranteed the Rick.
Yo, this your dude, Insane G.
What up? This your boy, Jihad, a.k.a. J Hood.
Yo, this your folks, Young Birds.
Yo, this your folk, GB. Cooney.
Yo, this is Mike G Jungle. Hey, what it do? It's your boy Size Money.
This your boy Big Chad Domingo.
Bye bye. Salute the big dog.
This your boy J Futuristic.
This your folk Lil Raheem. You did.
I am Geronimo Beals. Off the deep end, getting blessings. Wise Life Records, and you're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., the CEO, coming to you live.
Hey, what it do? This is Charlie Boy, the Versatile Child.
You're listening to the hottest radio station.
Are you ready to be inspired, uplifted, enlightened, and entertained? Judge Joe Brown is an all-American judge, lawyer, and television personality. Judge Joe Brown was raised in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, California. Overcoming the harsh streets of L.A., he graduated at the top of his class from Dorsey High School. He then went on to earn his bachelor's degree in political science at UCLA. Judge Joe Brown is a member of the Phi Alpha fraternity and became the first African-American prosecutor in Memphis, Tennessee. He then opened his own practice before becoming a judge on the state criminal court of Shelby County, Tennessee. Judge Joe Brown was then thrusted into the national spotlight, proceeding over James Earl's last appeal for race conviction for the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He then caught the attention of producers of Judge Judy and is now the arbiter of his own arbitration-based reality court TV show that has been recorded for over 16 years. This show is syndicated on Bounce and available to millions of homes across America. Judge Joe Brown has been on a mission to educate the leaders of the future and has started a movement titled Sag Pants Equals a Sag Mind. This is a call to action. Let's talk and change the world. Judge Joe Brown is ready to speak at your next event. Follow Judge Joe Brown at Judge Joe Brown TV on Twitter. This message has been brought to you by 2Deep, owner of KFSM Radio and Bloody Rain Productions, and Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team. Contact 2Deep at 337-936- 5176 or Pastor Don Jr. at 818-358-5722.
The NEO Project is a business network collective of professional CEOs, community leaders, doctors, recording artists, label owners, lawyers, judges, business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major connections across the globe. For more information, visit www.myprojectneo.org or call 800-249-8830. We have a live conference call. Join in the conversation hosted by Dr. Rev Robinson Sr. and Dr. Winborn. Share your ideas about growing your business. New ideas, featured partner, video promo, social media, exposure, rotation, profit sharing, meetups at your establishment. Join the conference call on Blog Talk Radio Thursday and Friday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Sunday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time, Live Talk with Eva. Call 347-857-1311. Press 1 to speak on freeconferencecall.com. Saturday, 12 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time, call into 515-604-9642, access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, hashtag T-Mobile or Boost Mobile, call 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, T-Mobile, or Boost Mobile, dial 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. Financial consulting and investments, call DSNR Consultants LLC Corporate Office, 914-363-9007. Text 518-866-7605. Email RevRunRobinson, RevRun11@gmail.com. Shout out to Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and Keisha Miss, CEO, the 300 Elite members, also 3 Max and a Nerd, and Andrea's Talent Management.
Fashion is SoSeductiveLive.com. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. SoSeductiveLive has the best apparel from Gucci, Prada, Fendi, Guess, Rolex, Nike, Tiara Michelle, True Religion, Louis Vuitton.
Greetings, I'm Miss K, CEO and founder of SoSeductive Shoes and Fashion. I started my company to keep you informed. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I believe in fashion, so SoSeductive is fun and needs to be seen. I want to inspire people just like you. I want someone to look at me and say, because of you, I didn't give up. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I am Miss K, CEO and founder of SoSeductive Shoes and Fashion. You can find me on your favorite social network at Keisha Miss CEO. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com.
There's a lot to learn in the music business, and without a teacher, it gets even harder and very costly. Introducing the Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint. Don Jr., CEO of the Entertainment Worldwide Network, has put together a detailed book to take your career to the next level in the entertainment business. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint will teach you the do's and don'ts of the entertainment industry, starting from the beginning to the end. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint covers the topics of business plan, logo design, CD design layout, sales, radio airplay, CD marketing strategy, massive emailing, CD sales one sheet, press kit, media kit, online media kit, internet marketing, MP3 online distribution, hip-hop blog sites, hip-hop magazines, hip-hop DVDs, mixtapes, street teams, music publishing and royalties, music lawyers, tour booking, and more. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint is available only by contacting Don Jr., CEO, at 818-358-5722 or email donjrceo@gmail.com.
Do you need more exposure? Do you need more fans? Are you planning to be wealthy and successful in business? The 365 Days of Radio campaign is a business training program teaching you how to build your brand, business, product, or service, how to meet and network with people in other cities, how to make connections with other business owners, and how to talk about your business on an open platform. All the tools you need before you speak to investors, advertisers, and or sponsors. Are you ready to receive money and make it to the next level? Education is the key to success, and experience is the best teacher. Learn from the comfort of your own personal remote location. The 365-day radio campaign is a business training program. For business training, tuition, schedules, and fees, please call Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and the winning team at 818-358-5722. That's right, Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team at 818-358-5722.
Yeah! Entertainment.
Worldwide.
Network.
Network.
We on live.
We in your speakers.
And
on your mind.
On your mind.
10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
We on time.
And we are back with the East Government Wealth Federation Incorporated, Comma Incorporated, the Local 26 Auxiliary, Women's Auxiliary. Let me get that straight so we understand that clearly, is the Women Auxiliary. And we are on with the host, with the most, Mrs. Sadie Gomez. And let's get her back in the conversation as well. Okay, is she muted? Can you hear us? Okay.
Yeah, this is Sadie Gomez of the Ethiopian World Federation Incorporated, Local 26, for the Women's Auxiliary. Thank you so much, Dr. Robinson. How are we doing in the studio this evening, since I'm unable to see my wonderful audience?
We're still here waiting for ones to come as well. Okay.
Maybe you can give me your thoughts on Juneteenth, since you would have had experience.
Juneteenth, like many of the historical events that happen in America, had a lot of distortion to it as well. So you have to sort of read through the lines and try to find the facts. It's supposed to be the day that the last set of slaves was set free, because states. Each state had their own law system, system set up, and so each one ended slavery at their time factors. Even though the government said, you know, this is the date, each state had ended it according to their time factors. So South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, Virginia, you know, all the southern states, y'all know all the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, so forth and so on. They were all against freeing the slaves because it was the economic base for them, and they were making a lot of money. And so the North didn't so much that they loved the slaves and didn't want slavery, but they didn't see equal distribution of the funds. So they were saying, okay, maybe if we stop slavery, maybe the monies can funnel up to the North, New York, you know, New York, Connecticut, California, you know, Texas wasn't part of the southern states. Chicago, you know, y'all know what I'm talking about, going up north, Boston, Vermont, you know, going all the northern states, wanted that money to filter up to them. And we didn't have that many states back then anyway, because we had just formulated what they called the union. It was a union of 13 states. And the union turned into many other things. So Juneteenth is considered the last set of slaves that were that gotten free, and that was told that slavery is over and was free. Now, if you want to call, it's a catch-22 for me, because if you want to say, you know, somebody saying, okay, go, you're free. But at the same time, you have no language, you have no identification, you have no citizenship, you got no constitution, no legal rights, you can't get a job, and the government never did anything. See, America, the way that they controlled the slaves, even after they so-called freed them, they put them in an economic condition that what they had to do. They had to go back to the master and say, listen, please let me come back. People were walking around with signs saying, I work for food. That's how bad the condition was. So freeing the slaves is one thing, and I'm not saying everybody, because there are people, the Moorish Americans who are black, who've been here before Columbus, before slavery, and somehow they just walked around all these or these slave conditions. These are black people who were here prior, and they were walking, according to the history, they were walking around, and they owned slaves as well, but they treated them better, and they had more slaves than anybody else, according to the statistics, because they had more money. So in that, you know, there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of confusion in the historical facts of it, but, you know, I'm still saying America did nothing to stop the dehumanizing conditions, the suffering, and nothing to repay, reorganize or reinstate, whatever you want to call it, back into the society. An immigrant comes to America, they get, you know, the opportunity to get a residency, to get a naturalization, they go through a process. Remember, the slaves had no process, nothing, just that you're free. So now when you're free, you got to figure out how to eat, how to live, where to live. Then you couldn't live any place. Then the laws, they made laws that if you're a vagrant walking around without any identification, no address, you'd be locked up because they didn't want people walking around. They didn't want vagrants walking around. So it could be bittersweet. You know what I'm saying? It's a lot to, for me, I believe the way they did that, the way they did the trickery, the way they released the so-called slaves out of the dehumanizing experience, the way the whole process was done, as far as I'm concerned, it was a setup. I believe that's why we're in the condition that we're in now. I believe because of the fact of the matter is they try to cover up slavery, try to continue slavery, they try to continue to use black people for their financial purposes. We are in a condition now where people, black Americans, African Americans, whatever you want to call them, they're saying whether they should stay here or go back to Africa and try to make a life, because there's no life here even today. So, you know, it's terrible. I think it's a terrible situation that we're in now, making the decision to stay here or to leave here and go back to Africa and start a new life. And then you get to Africa, then there's a whole other, you know, set of circumstances there that you have to try to get yourself assimilated. There's a lot of processing. And so it's bittersweet for me. You know, and it's very confusing. I understand what people are trying to celebrate. I understand the ideology of it. But there's a lot of things for me personally that I'm not celebrating. I don't want America to think they did me a favor. I don't want them to think that, you know, they did such a big, you know, by us celebrating, you know, and by Biden signing the bill, it sounds like they're doing something for us. Then even signing that bill, that's nice. But where is the economics that we lost? Where is the time that we lost? All the things that we lost as human beings participating and building this country and getting nothing for it, 300 years behind economically, and if it's a lie, they are telling it. For every $171 white people got, black people got a dollar. So I just don't, you know, for me, I'm just saying we've got to change. There's something more got to come out of this than just celebrating and making the white man feel like he's doing somebody a favor, because he's not. And when you do the economic status of it, when you check it out, you know, you'll find that that's what we're dealing with. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, make nobody feel bad or nothing like that. I'm just telling you, that's the way I feel about it. I don't know. I just don't see all the trickery.
You're on the right track, Dr. Robinson. That's why I asked, what does it mean for us? Because I understand that Martin Luther King wanted to have a march around the White House concerning a poor man's march to commemorate this day, but that never took place, so there was no great significance into what this day means, seeing that he was assassinated 1 month after.
Right, right. Exactly. Which is what Reverend Dr. Barber is doing now, William Barber. He is picking up what Dr. King left off and got killed for, which is the Poor People's Campaign. and what Dr. King was saying, the distribution of funds between the wealthy and the poor is unequal. And that's whether you're white, Spanish, immigrant, just came here, or African-American born here, whatever you want to call it. Dr. King said the distribution of funds is not correct. That's why you have, and you're going to have, a substantial numbers of people in poverty, and that's why poverty is going to continue to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Now, I'll say this to say this. If anybody do mathematics, economics, understand the matriculation of numbers, do the math. America got more money than it has people. Why do anybody have to go to bed hungry? I'm not saying everybody has to be a millionaire, zillionaire, trillionaire, thousandaire, whatever. But I'm saying, why do people have to die? Because they have pre-existing conditions in which they don't have money to afford it. And this is black, white, green, orange, you know, immigrant, whoever. Everybody is in this situation, whether white people understand it or don't understand it. Why do people have to die, though, when there's more money in this country than there's people? So that tells you right then there's misuse. And there is by design, a distribution of funds unequally to one portion of the society, and other society
any portion
is suffering. Right, right. And so we gotta say to this government, to these Democrats who keep calling me every doggone day, I get called from Democratic candidates, Ron, why you don't sign this bill? Ron, why you don't support this? Ron, give me $100. Ron, give me $200. The Republicans are winning. Then the Republicans call me, Ron, the Democrats are tearing down the country. The economy is going bad. Putin is killing all the people in Ukraine. Ron, we have to change these things. Give me $100. Give me $20. Give me $50. These parties will put a question on the internet, y'all. I just want to show you all what's going on. They'll put a question on the internet, tell you to answer the question, and then when you're ready to answer the question, they'll say, in order for us to submit your answer, you have to give us $100, $50, $30, or whatever. And I'm saying to myself, here we got a country with all this money, and people are being denied this money. People are directly being denied the opportunity to get this money. People are losing their jobs and never seeing a job again. People are going under impoverished levels that America can't even count. There's sub-economic poverty in America, y'all. And all I'm saying is, with all of this, they still begging, politicians still beg for money. Years and years after they don't left their position, they still begging for money to keep their campaign going. I'm just saying there's something wrong with this whole picture. There's something wrong with this whole picture, and we got to look at it from we as human people, human beings, a part of the human race. We have to learn to come together and combat these things, because as long as we're fragmented, hating each other, calling each other names, those people who y'all keep saying the rich is getting richer. Why? Because ain't nobody paying attention to the bank. Nobody paying attention to where the money's going. And this is what they do. They call chaos amongst people. And while y'all ignorant, fighting each other over color of skin or hair, or, you know, one is this and one is that, one person is that, one language, religion, sexuality, whatever the nonsense is going on, they just keep collecting money on top of money. That's why the rich get rich and the poor get poorer, because the rich are just collecting. They're doing rich things and collecting this money while everybody's acting like the fool. So my suggestion is we learn at least to come together to make sure, because these monies that they're spending is our money. It first started by the slave money, because that's how it became the richest economy in the world. Then it's people work and pay taxes. That's another, you know, combination of things. You're paying your taxes, but when you get sick, you can't get no money to relieve you of your sickness, so you have to die. When you get homeless, you can't get nothing to help you keep you in a home or keep your existing mortgage or rent. You have to go out in the street and be in a shelter and be belittled. by society that stigmatizes you and call you homeless and call you all kind of names and, you know, put you in shelters. All that stuff is a human act. They don't have to be. Not when you got more money than you got people. So let's watch these people because they're smart and they're slick. And if you don't watch them, they do what they do. You know, it's incredible to me.
While you're paying taxes, they're not paying taxes.
Exactly. And they get the glory of everything. They get the benefit of everything. There's a Rule 72, y'all. If you get 30%, 40% return on your interest on your dollar, your investment will matriculate quicker. That means if you get 30%, your investment will turn around in 2 to 3 months. If you get 40%, Rule 72, 42 goes into 72 how many times, you'll get your money back in probably about 36 days. If you're getting 60% interest on your dollar, you'll probably get your money back in a couple of weeks. That's what they're doing. That's what the 1%ers do. That's what the rich do. They play Rule 72. They go into the bank and they go to foreign countries. They take all this money that you put in a yielding IRA account or something like that. The bank said, let us keep this $100,000, Ms. Jones, for 5 years. We're going to give you a five and a quarter percent interest on your money over 5 years, not compounding interest, pure straight interest, okay? So we're going to take your money 5 years to mature. Not that it's going to double itself, but it'll probably go half of the money that you put in. So you put in 100, you'll probably get $40. Let's say that. But they, the rich, the wealthy, put their money into these foreign investments. They're getting 32%, 42%, 72%, whatever percent they're getting, and they're getting their money back. Tons of three, their money is tripling. They put $1,000, they're getting $5,000, $6,000, and they're getting it in weeks and months. And this is the difference. And this is why they get so rich. And they love when conditions are like they are, when they keep talking about, oh, we're going into a recession. The economy is terrible. It's bad because they scare everybody away. There's no competition, and all they do is go and buy up everything. While you're scared and you're not, you're willing to sell your whatever it is for, you know, 10 cents, 1 cent, 3 cents on the dollar, they just buy it up. They buy it up and buy it up, and when the economy flips again, they say, okay, they own everything. This is the game is played, you know what I'm saying? But this is a part of slavery. It's how they matriculated economies from the time of slavery, and they found it works for them. When they started working, when they opened up the banks, the 1%ers who opened up the banks in America, they sat down and they figured all of that out. They figured out everything, how to make money. You think they just say, free the slaves and let them go, and we're not going to make no money? No. They figured out how to maintain the financial status that they're at and to maintain the finances the way the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And, you know, and as you see people who become a part of the wealthy environment makes money, you know, they make money. You know what I'm saying? They continue, you know, to become a part of that system. Trump made all those billions of dollars. He paid $720. And that was not so much taxes, y'all. That was fees to the accountants, you know. So go figure it out, you know. Go figure it out. It's to me, it's just, you know, certain things are common sense things, and I understand, like, everybody's not privy to certain information, you know, especially black people. We're kept out of, you know, if we want to be. You can Google everything now, y'all. If anybody tell you any scientific study, even if Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the greatest and the smartest astrophysicist in the world, if he says an equation to you, and you don't even have to know nothing about astrophysicism, you don't have to know nothing about it. You can Google anything he tell you. And Google will tell you exactly if the formula is correct. So you don't have to be, nobody has to be stupid. Everything I'm telling you is common knowledge. You just have to go and put it into the system and, you know, just see it for what it is. You know what I'm saying? That, you know, so educate yourself. Keep yourself educated. Don't let people tell you anything. We're in the age of information. And I dare say everyone should stay abreast of information because it's simplistic, it's simple, it's easy. Your children know. Your children know, even though they're being misguided, miseducated, you know. And don't take this race, what they're saying about this critical race theory, like history is critical race theory, and it's dehumanizing white people, and it's dehumanizing white kids, it's making them feel so insignificant and so insecure about being white. It's making them feel bad about being white. Don't let them sell that crap to you, because all they're doing is saying that we're not going to teach nothing about black history. We don't want to desensitize people that we did all these dehumanizing things to black people. They don't want no white person to know what's going on because they don't want to desensitize them to the conditions in which they put us in, dehumanizing conditions. And we're even a 0.% above, out of the conditionings that we experience. It's duplicating itself. One great, smart, intelligent man from therein said that if history is not understood, is not taught, is not reviewed in its natural form or understanding or whatever, it will continue to repeat itself. And that's what they're doing. They're destroying the history here in America, the events that actually happened, so they can continue to go on and on and on and on and give you crumbs from the table and you feel happy. That's how it goes. You know, welcome to America.
The land of the free and the brave and the everything else. But what we want to say here, Dr. Robinson, your contribution to this conversation was really, really wonderful. You're right on point with us understanding, too, that if they can erase certain evils that was done and they can look as Mr. Nice Guy once more, but Google doesn't allow it because everything is out there. We are in the age of information and a lot of hidden things can surface. But what do we have to do as a people? We are still so much blinded, although some of us are awoke, and we give thanks for that. Within the last 5 years, you know, a lot of people have been waking up out of their deep slumber, which is something really good. But for those of us who have, you know, it in our power to do so, we look around for our black leaders, our significant black men, that who can carry this battle once more, you know, where the brave, strong soul is. Because this event of Juneteenth, the merchants will make some money. Well, what is the black people to do concerning this? As you talk about our economy and our financial status within the whole, you know, things as we watch ourselves, we watch our people, and we see they're just happy-go-lucky going around. And what are we really doing as a people as we observe a day like today when we know so much was sacrificed and given so that we could even have a day like today? So how's our studio looking, Dr. Robinson?
Yeah, it's still in the same position itself.
All right. Oh, okay, we'd have probably have a little time because I know a lot of people.
I'd like to say one more point so we can, you know, one thing that we have been delusionized is that we black people think, oh, you know what, I'm over here and it's a little different than for me than them over there, and then them over there is a little different for me. No, people, it's the same for all of us. Slavery extended itself beyond the borders of America. It was an institution built by Europe, and it grew all over. Look at the Aborigines people in Australia. They were enslaved. It didn't stop. It didn't start with America. It was an international operations. Okay, it was making crazy money. America just ended up getting a crazy economy because a lot of other things that were going on as well. But I'm just saying to us that we have to be aware that it wasn't so different from one person to the other person to the other person. We as a people all was affected based on our culture of coming from Africa. We were all affected based on the color of our skin and our hair. Nobody had a better situation. Nobody had a worse situation. We were all affected. And that's one thing we have to stop and understand. This is a universal crisis. It's not just an American crisis, not just a Caribbean crisis, an African crisis, European, Europe crisis, Asia, South America. Everywhere you go, whether it's China, Korea, they're finding black people in, I forgot the name of this country, but nobody thought in the week, Norway. Okay, they're finding black folks in Belgium being abused right now. They got blacks in China being abused right now. Japanese have black kids that were left over from the soldiers when they went to the war, and they were hating on black men in the German in Germany during World War II because the German girls were interested in them, and they end up having kids with those girls, and they are black Germans in Germany being abused. So I'm just saying to us as a people, wherever we at, you know, we have to start uniting together to eradicate any level of abuse. They were abusing black Africans in China when the COVID-19 came. Nobody said nothing. They were literally just in China walking up to Africans in the street and just jumping them and beating them down. Women, men, boys, girls, whatever, okay? They were very abusive in China, very dehumanizing to our people. And this goes on and this goes on, and I can give you case after case after case after case all over the world. So when are we going to learn to join together, fight together to eradicate any kind of dehumanizing conditions for any black person? Wherever it happens, it affects all of us. And we have to take it that way. If my brother and sister suffer in the Caribbean, I'm suffering. If they suffer in Africa, I'm suffering. Their war becomes my war. My war should be their war. The only way we're going to eradicate this crap, we got to come together and say, hey, listen, we understand it. We see where it's coming from, and we're going to stop it. No more. Just say that. We just have to tell them. We will not continue to accept. I'm not running from America. I'm not leaving to go find no place. It's nice. When I'm going to leave on my terms. I'm going to leave when Ron Robinson's ready to leave, because I want to leave. I'm not letting nobody push me out. I'm not letting nobody scare me out. I will die if I have to, but no more. No more. I'm not accepting this behavior. I don't have to accept it. And I don't, you know, it's just not acceptable. And I'm going to let these crackers know I'm not accepting this. You know what I'm saying? These little kids around here now, Sadie, they got all these guns and just walking into school, killing 26 people. They got $9,000 to $10,000 worth of equipment. The man said, the little boy that killed all the people in Texas, he said, where did this kid get this stuff from? He has no job. He has no credit. His mother and father are poor. And he's walking around with $10,000 worth of ammunition and guns and whatnot. And he, you know what I'm saying? Somebody got to be supplying these people with this stuff. They're not in the position to buy this kind of stuff. They don't have that kind of money. And so this is a part of...
You have those with the hidden agenda who is lurking in the background, and they would push these youths who are anxious forward, because as you said, how practical could it be? A child 18 years or just turned 18 can buy $9,000 worth of ammunition when he doesn't even have a bank account or any money. So who is funding him, or who is challenging him along? So when we look and we examine, it's really bigger than just this one kid who supposedly went to the school and killed all these babies. This was quite divine. He was elected to do so, and he's functioning his role. I'm glad we are observing things at a different level.
Nobody noticed that all the kids that he killed was Hispanic. They were Mexican,
yeah, of course.
Or South Central. No, they were Mexican or El Salvadorian or Peru, in which all those people that come from across, walk across Mexico to the border. You know,
yeah.
Nobody noticed that. Pacific school was designed around.
There was only one white girl, right? One little white girl that lost her life. But other than that, they were all really from that, and they could tell in their faces that Mexico, El Salvador, Honduras, that type of people. They weren't Puerto Ricans. They weren't that other tribe.
Exactly. And so
their parents, you know.
Yeah.
Their parents are not wealthy.
Exactly. You got demonic evil people, and
mm-hmm.
they just don't care. And, you know, they don't care who they kill, how they kill them. And if you're a good person of their persuasion, and that person is a good white person that decides they don't want to participate in this kind of behavior, they're marching with different groups against this type of thing. And so they say, you know what? We have to get rid of the whites too. You know, get rid of the good whites that want to do the right thing.
Well, if you notice, his shooting came right after the grocery shooting, and the grocery shooting was mostly black.
Exactly.
Which was what, a month before when the grocery shooting took about 13 people or 19 or somewhere along that line. Even to the security guard, he got killed. That group was mostly black.
They got little kids, all right, 3, 4, 5 years old, going on videos saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a killer. I want to kill this one. I want to kill him. I want to kill. I mean, and people are watching this, and that's not child abuse. The little boy goes into the store at 3 years old. He know how to break down an AK-47 faster than a soldier can. That's not child abuse. Those anti-social organizations out there, the KKK, the Nazis, the skinheads, they got little kids 3 and 5 years old shooting rifles at black people. The target practice is pictures of black people. That's not child abuse. These going behind people are using the minds of children to manipulate them to want to kill, you know, the gays, the blacks, the Jews, you know. And that's not, and America's sitting there watching this stuff, and they don't know these the same kids are going to grow up and walk into the store and blow everybody's brains out. They don't know that.
Well,
nobody's talking about that.
Dr. Robinson, only in America you have this type of killing, this type, because there's no other country in the world whereby you see a child who didn't feel good on a Monday morning walking to school and kill. From even since that day when that guy with the black trench coat walked into the school and he killed 17,
mm-hmm.
I can't remember, that was the greatest massacre that we have seen until such this time. But what you notice, there's not a country in the world that has that sort of behavior. Russia don't have it. Sweden, Germany, England, Spain. We have some crazies in France who may blow up a train station or something. But we see in America this type of crime is exclusive to America. So we are wondering what are the children exposed to.
They got this thing called Aryan Nation, right? The Nazis.
Yeah.
The Aryan Nation was born out of Nazi terrorists in Germany at the time when they were developing the Holocaust against the Jews. So this Aryan Nation thing was built. These Aryan Nations are not as well organized, you know, they're not organized to do the kind of killings they do here in America. But a lot of the people, and when you find a lot of these groups over here in America, Proud Boys, the Nazis, the skinheads, the KKK, and you talk and they interview them, a lot of them come from Germany. They come from France. They come from Belgium. They come from Switzerland, Austria. You know, they're also, you know, young, you know, new immigrants here as well. And, you know, in France, they were having those killings or whatever they was having at different things. But I'm saying it's something that could grow because a lot of these people are mental and a lot of them just duplicate, you know, copycat killers, their mental condition is that kind of way. And, you know, so as well as, you know, it can start here in America. In America, I don't know why, but it tends to be like a trend-setting thing. difference when you see certain things happen so many times in America. You see duplications or copycats in other places, you know, to a certain extent. But I'm thanking God that it's not as prevalent in Europe as it is here. And I'm hoping that, you know, we get a handle on it. Because if you don't, there's so many crazy people out there, you know, and there's a lot of haters as well. And, you know, it easily can get out of hand, you know, this type of thing. It easily can go crazy. Because you know that a lot of these kids used to, they found a lot of Americans sympathizing with Hamas and all these terror groups that were forming in the Middle East and different places and Arab countries. A lot of these white kids were joining them. You know, they were right from America. Remember, they were cutting their hair low and buying guns and stuff and getting on airplanes and try to join Hamas and Hezbollah and all these terrorist groups. It's mental. You know, it's a mental situation, you know.
When mental health is on the rise, we are seeing more and more of it with younger and younger people. It's really a case now where it's an uncontrollable state because mental health is so difficult to detect. Is really only you can help is if a family member or someone close to that person can make that report, because you now have to observe behavioral patterns with an individual to decide if he is sane or insane, because as we know, it's a very thin line between sanity and insanity. So it's very difficult to detect, and I'm seeing more and more cases of early mad people because they're still clean. They still, you know, have a profile where they appear to be working or something is going on. But if you look good into their faces, they're way, way or far away. Because, you know, I take the train, so I would see it. And I say, wow, a lot of young people are just going crazy with the pressures of life. And, of course, you know, too, not having that connection with the Holy Spirit or the Almighty, or you want to call him Jah or Allah or God, whatever you want to call him. But if we fail in our life to have that void between us and the Holy Spirit, or that comforter, that joy of Christ, or knowing the heavens, we will begin to go mad. We will. Because there's too much going on with right now. With spiritually, we are being tested, tried, tortured, and bounced around. So it's a spiritual warfare right now. And only if we could move closer to the Almighty God would we have a chance in even surviving. And that is even mentally.
Right, right. And the mental, they will self-medicate. They will easily get into any kind of drugs, street kind of drugs. And with the drug they're taking now, which is, you know, in itself a controlled substance, opioids and all that kind of stuff, methamphetamines and all them things, that has a devastating mental control on them. You know, so that situation can be quite devastating as well. You know,
yes,
and so
we see that. And then
for the next part of the conversation, as we go along the evening, it seems that we're not having much people on, because I know most of my friends, they took time off to go see, you know, two of them with their kids in a kind of picnic atmosphere. And I know all the BCCs are social life, and I didn't even, she didn't come on because she had been so engaged. And it's this type of evening, so we see who else would come on, but maybe we're having quite an early evening. We have Dr. Winborn. He went to dinner by his daughter.
He had a previous meeting as well.
Right, I just
speak to you. Are we getting closer to the, we're getting closer and closer to, you know, the convention, which is going to be held in, it's going to be held in Ethiopia, Shashimani. So they're organizing that as well. There's a lot of things with the they're doing something with the Ethiopian Airlines to get special rates and stuff like that for groups and things of that sort. And there's certain things got to be organized for the government perspective, you know, certain things that's needed, you know.
So, very well imagined.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what you're talking about this evening as well is the fact that those who were given the vaccination is now being told that they are not allowed to give blood. Their blood is not accepted. And this is a real situation with a woman who is a nurse, gave this report with family members that came in to give blood to someone who was in her care and had an emergency. And when they came to draw the blood, the phlebotomist was, they have questions that they ask you. And one of the questions was, did you take the vaccine? And once you answer yes, it disqualifies you from drawing your blood. So your blood will not be stored in any blood bank or given to any patient. Even your family or relative will now have to die because you are unable to give blood once you have taken the vaccine. This is stipulation at the various hospitals. So I just learned this recently. Do you know anything about this, Dr. Robinson?
No, I'm sorry. Say that again.
I said, do you know anything about this?
Yeah. Say this because I sort of missed you in a way.
Yeah, that people who were given the vaccination, they were told that they are not allowed to give blood.
Yes. Oh, yes. It wasn't quite clear. You know what I'm saying? When they make the statement, it was people who was told in a private setting or environment, whatever, came out and said that's what they was told. But as far as the CDC or the health organizations or Fauci and his group coming out, the WHO, and saying that, on a regular basis, no, they haven't made official statement.
They haven't made that statement as yet. You know, Fauci and they, but this is a case where a nurse in a hospital, she was able to make this report because she had an emergency situation and patients came, family members came to give blood. And when the phlebotomist had questions, she was asked to ask the family members. And once that those who took the vaccination, they were not allowed. They were disqualified as a blood donor. But
right.
As you said, no
right.
big organizations like WHO and, you know, everybody else, the powers that be, they haven't made that statement because, of course, it's quite undercover and, you know, slippery and slimy, this business.
Correct.
So that's just what we're up against in a time like this. So, as you said, Dr. Robinson, now our board is looking for...
Our board is, let me take a look here. Okay. Yeah, it's the board is in the same position as well.
Okay, so it's going to be quite an early evening. We can wrap up. It's this holiday type of mood for most people, so no, I don't have anyone coming on particularly because I know they're far away. At this time, you know, we basically covered an hour in conversation, roughly. The other time, you know,
let me see here. There was a great, there's a great study. It's an extensive thing, but it's a great study. Attorney Jeff Robinson did a study on slavery, did some interviews, did some revealing some stuff. And I don't know if you want to hear some of that.
You
get displayed?
What's that now?
No, because said we don't have our studio audience to receive the Sunday evening. So I said you can either play some music or if you want to go into commercial.
Yeah, I mean,
because
if you want me to play,
I'm done for
historical research. The gentleman attorney Jeff Robinson did an internal and external research on slavery, and he have this revealing reports that he gives. I don't know if you want to hear some of that.
Yeah, you can only play because I'm done for the evening and knowing that,
okay.
You know, that type of evening. So we can just occupy the time. If you want to play that, we listen.
Okay. All right. Very good.
If you have ever owned a slave, please raise your hand. Slavery is not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't cause it. It's not our responsibility. But it is our shared history. And when we try and turn it into something that it's not, when we try and make more light of it than it was, then we are denying who we really are, and we are impeding our ability to truly move forward as a community or as a nation.
In most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people were treated as family?
That's basically the way it was down south.
So what I want to talk to you about is part of the ugliness of our history. I want all of us to understand just how we laid the groundwork to own other human beings as property.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male, and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. 41 of the 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned other human beings as property. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people.
What kind of things happened here?
Lynchings or hangings took place here on this very spot.
Black folks here in Charleston refer to it as the lynching tree.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. It is not an either or.
There must be a revolution of values in our country, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and we were seemingly, to me, at a tipping point where we were either going to roll forward with this incredible momentum on racial justice, or we could roll back. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck, and it felt like the whole thing just rolled back.
And a man grabbed me by the arm and said, "We don't allow blacks in the gym." And I remember turning to y'all and I said, "They've got a problem with the clock and with what's going on here. We all are out here. We're leaving."
I didn't know that.
I figured that.
Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the reason I'm asking us to think about this is that literally the future is at stake.
And Larry, he came out with his hands in the air and said, "Don't shoot." Put the shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger at close range.
And what I'm going to ask us to do tonight is to have a naked lunch moment with race in America. It's that moment when everyone has to take a look at what is really on the end of their fork.
If I may ask you a question, Jeff. Perhaps if Dylann Roof was educated, if he understood that he may not have gone down this path, what are your thoughts?
This is not going to be easy, but I can promise you this. It will never get easier to have an honest discussion about race in America than it is right now. Because if we wait, it is only going to get harder.
The Larry that you heard referred to in that trailer was a young man named Larry Payne, who was 6 years older than I was, and he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee the week before King was assassinated, 1 week to the day. There was a march in support of striking sanitation workers, and that march broke into violence. Larry was confronted by a police officer who put a shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger. And his memory has been one of the things that's been forgotten about the garbage strike and the movement in Memphis. So I am Jeff Robinson, and I am a criminal defense lawyer from Seattle, Washington. And you could be asking, why are you here and why are you doing this? And that would be a completely legitimate question. And this is the way I'm going to answer it. In 2011, I became a parent because my wife's younger sister, Jeannie, who lived in Queens, New York, was suffering from MS and she passed away. And her 13-year-old son, Matthew, my nephew, then became my 13-year-old son because he was being raised by Jeannie and Jeannie's mother. Jeannie passed away in April of 2011, and her mom, my wife's mom, passed away in November of 2011. So Matt lost both of his parents. His father was never in the picture, and he moved to Seattle. Now, I was terrified about being a parent because I didn't know anything about how to do that. And I was scared a lot. But I was more scared because there was a young black man that moved into my home. And my work as a criminal defense lawyer in Seattle had been for 30 or 35 years working on issues of racial justice, working on issues for clients of color, working and speaking around the country on these issues. They were very important to me, but they were academic to a certain extent until Matthew showed up on my doorstep. And I got scared. And one of the reasons I was scared is that there had been a narrative going on in America about young black men for more than a decade, and it went something like this.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Bring them to heel. As soon as you start talking about human beings like they're animals, get ready for some really bad shit to come. Because that's how we do it in America. We dehumanize people before we start to treat them as less than human. And so I was scared and I didn't know what to do, and I just started reading. And as I started reading, I was shocked. I didn't even know what I was looking for. But I started reading facts about our history in America that I had never seen before, that I had never heard before. And it was just scaring me, and it was shocking me. And it was shocking me because, as I said in that clip, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1956, and was assassinated in 1968. The civil rights movement wasn't something I read about in a book. It was what we were living when we stepped out the door of our house in the black neighborhoods in Memphis, Tennessee, every day of our lives. And yet I was reading about these facts about our history that I had never heard before. I have had one of the best educations in America. I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School, and nobody ever taught me this stuff. And so I felt humiliated. And then I felt angry because I thought, well, how come nobody taught me this? And so I thought, I'm going to forgive myself and get pissed off at my teachers, and I'll blame them. And then I thought, well, how could they have taught me if they weren't taught? And the amazing thing about this stuff is that these facts are hiding in plain sight. All you have to do is go and look, because human beings, from the time of the cave drawings in France that are 30,000 years old, human beings have a trait that has always been part of our existence. When we think we're doing something important, we write stuff down. And we keep it so people can read it later. And our history, from the time the colony started, is written down in plain fact for anybody that wants to take a look. And so I started to take a look, and I started to do these presentations about 7 or 8 years ago. And as they developed, I kept doing them, and I gave a presentation in 2017 in New York City. And one of the people in the audience was a woman named Sarah Kunstler. Is Sarah's father-in-law in the audience? Do I hear anybody? Could you stand up and introduce yourself, please? Thank you, John, for coming, and I please give him a hand. Because Sarah Kunstler is the daughter of the famed civil rights lawyer William Kunstler. And Sarah came up to me after the presentation and said, I'd like you to meet my sister Emily, because we own a film company and we'd like to make a documentary about your presentation. And I thought that was the most stupid thing I had ever heard in my entire life. 1 year later, we are performing in Town Hall Theater on Broadway in New York City in front of a sold-out audience with 7 cameras filming. And since that time, we have gone across America filming interviews to put together a documentary called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. What I'm here to do tonight is to give you an idea of what this documentary will cover and to give you a sense of the arc of the documentary, because I think that's perhaps the most important thing about this film is the arc that we're trying to cover. When people talk about slavery and atrocities that have happened in our past, what we often hear is, yeah, but that was a long time ago. It doesn't have any impact on the way things are today. And that's something that I want to challenge with this film. And so what I'd like to do is to walk through 4 segments of this arc. And this won't be everything that the documentary covers, I promise you that. But it will give you a flavor for the things that I think can make America look at who we are differently and can make us take steps that we have not yet taken in our existence. This stuff was hiding in plain sight. The term white supremacy is a difficult term and an extreme term. And I think it is used, and some people feel that it might be overused. What I want you to consider is that white supremacy was one of the founding pillars of American society. Now, if you think that's an overstatement, in the documentary, we will walk through the historical documents that will lay this out clearly. But some of what you'll see is that we know in 1619 we have these records of 20 and odd enslaved people landing somewhere near Jamestown, Virginia. But did you know that by 1790, American cotton production had grown to 1.5 million pounds a year? Has anybody on the stage ever held a freshly picked piece of cotton in your hand? And I don't mean something out of an aspirin bottle, but like out of a field, no twigs. How much does it weigh? I can't tell you how many cotton balls that weigh near nothing it took to get to 1.5 million pounds, but I can tell you how many enslaved people it took, 700,000. In 171 years, America went from 20 and odd enslaved people to 700,000. And the details behind this story are part of what we will paint in the documentary with historical documents. Many people will say, if you're talking about the history of enslavement in America, you really can't talk about the colonies because that wasn't America yet. America didn't happen until we broke away from England. And what I'd like you to think about in terms of the arc of this story is that the white supremacy that was at the heart of the economic life of the colonial Americans was doubled down upon when we wrote our Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 is the three-fifths clause. Every black person in America was counted as three-fifths of a human being. If I asked people in this room before I started this presentation, what is affirmative action? Almost all of us would say, oh, those were programs of uplift in the 60s and 70s directed at the black community. And then at some point the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, that's reverse discrimination, and now there's kind of a balance. I'm not quite sure where it is. Many Americans think affirmative action started in the 1960s. Can you think of a more powerful form of affirmative action than giving one race of people the right to own another race? Article 1, Section 9, no ban on migration or importation of such persons before 1808. The word slavery, enslaved or slave, did not appear in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment. We'll get to that in a minute. Because the North understood that the South was upset by that word. It was kind of harsh. And so enslaved people were referred to as such persons. And no ban on migration meant that we need to keep the ships going to Africa to bring more enslaved people back because we are getting rich off of this. We can't cut this trade off until 1808. Article 2, Section 1. Each state shall appoint a number of electors equal to the number.
One reason,
to give the southern states a guarantee that they would have a significant role in electing the president of the United States. And here is where you will hear letters from people like Patrick Henry. Remember him, y'all? Give me liberty or give me death. Well, when the Constitutional Convention was happening, people thought they were doing something important. So they wrote stuff down. And Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet, so people had to write letters to each other. And Patrick Henry, you will see in the documentary, an actor reading Patrick Henry's letter about there are 236,000 blacks in Virginia and fewer none in the northern states. Multiply 236,000 by three-fifths and you still get a big number, especially considering the size of America at the time. This was done directly to further the interest of the slave-owning states. Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for any runaway slave must be returned on demand. And I was telling Art earlier, I've been giving this presentation or some version of it for 7 or 8 years, and I have just realized recently that this document says an incredible thing. This part of the Constitution makes it clear that from the first day that this country came into existence, America turned to its law enforcement officers and said, your job is to control, contain, and suppress every black face in America. We wrote it in the Constitution. Because if there's no freedom for a runaway, what does that mean? The United States Marshals Service is on you to bring you back to your owner. And finally, people say the folks that wrote the Constitution were brilliant, and they were. Go back to Article 1, Section 9. No state could pass a law saying you can't bring enslaved people from Africa into our state, because that would be unconstitutional. But these folks were wily. They said, what if folks try and amend the Constitution? And so they doubled down and they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until after 1808. They were going to keep those ships coming. The word slavery is mentioned once in the 13th Amendment, which did not rid America of slavery. neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, shall exist within the United States. That means that slavery and involuntary servitude do exist for people who have been convicted of a crime. Think about the new Jim Crow and mass incarceration in the light of this amendment. This was not done by mistake. And the documentary will demonstrate people knew exactly what they were doing when they wrote this amendment. So I wish I could see a show of hands. How many people know who the Colonial Marines were? I am trying to demonstrate how we have been deprived of the truth about our history. If you were never taught who the Colonial Marines were, the Colonial Marines were escaped enslaved people that fought for the British in the War of Independence and during the War of 1812. Why? Because the British said, if we win, you get your freedom. And the Colonial Marines in the War of 1812 were part of British troops that attacked the Americans right outside of Washington, D.C., drove them back into Washington, D.C., and set the White House on fire. And one of the people who was watching that happen was Francis Scott Key. And 3.5 weeks later, he was in Baltimore Harbor watching the bombing of Fort McHenry. And after 25 consecutive hours of bombing, when he saw the American flag still flying, he became overcome with patriotic fervor, and he wrote the poem that became the national anthem.
And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle of home and country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the
refuge can save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight, because we will hunt you down, or the gloom of the grave, because we will put you in the dirt if you dare fight against America for your freedom. And there are historians who will be anxious to tell you, well, Francis Scott Key wasn't talking about those enslaved people. He was talking about some other enslaved people. Francis Scott Key was a virulent racist. Francis Scott Key prosecuted a man in Washington, D.C. after the Civil War for possessing abolitionist literature, which carried the death penalty. Francis Scott Key called black Americans the worst plight to ever be inflicted on America. This is who wrote our national anthem, and these are the words. We may not sing them anymore, but they're there. And if you didn't know this, I wonder what you might think of black athletes who kneel quietly protesting racial injustice, knowing that this is our national anthem. And in the documentary, we will use all kinds of evidence to demonstrate just how much America relied on enslaving people. But this is an example of what it was about. The 1856 unique defense to the charge of murder that was put forward on behalf of Margaret Garner. And what Margaret Garner did is best described by a newspaper article from the Cincinnati Enquirer from 1856.
Great excitement existed throughout the city the whole day of yesterday in consequence of the arrest of a party of slaves and the murder of her child by a slave mother while officers were in the act of making the arrest. A party of 17 slaves escaped from Boone and Kenton counties in Kentucky about 16 miles from the Ohio on Sunday night last, and taking with them two horses and a sled, drove that night to the Ohio River opposite to Western Row in this city. Leaving the horses and sled standing there, they crossed the river on foot,
crossed the river
on the ice, on foot on the ice.
One of the narratives in America that has been very popular is that, yes, slavery was a bad thing, but it wasn't that bad. There were, like, good living conditions, and they had good food, and they were treated okay. Just how bad does it have to be for you to take your family and cross the Ohio River in the middle of the winter on foot, on the ice, not knowing if the ice will break, for you to fall through? It was bad enough that Margaret Garner and her family took that risk. And when the U.S. Marshals showed up the next day in Cincinnati to arrest her, as the Constitution required them to do, Margaret Garner took a knife, grabbed her daughter, and slit her throat. Then she went after her sons, and the marshals got to her before she could complete her task. This is an oil painting, a rendering of what Margaret Garner did, experienced. And Alfre Woodard helped us with reading that poem at the event in Town Hall in New York.
Then, said the mournful mother, if Ohio cannot save, I will do a deed for freedom. She shall find each child a grave. I will save my precious children from their darkly threatened doom. I will hew their path to freedom through the portals of the tomb. A moment in the sunlight, she held a glimmering knife. The next moment she had bathed it in the crimson fount of life. They snatched away the fatal knife. Her boys shrieked wild with dread. The baby girl was pale and cold. They raised it up. The child was dead. Send this deed for fearful daring through my country's heart, no thrill. To the icy hands of slavery, every pure emotion chill.
Like this. This is what slavery was. It wasn't something else. This is who we are as Americans when we talk about our history, because Margaret Garner was charged with first-degree murder for killing her daughter, and the murder charges were dismissed, because in order to be convicted of first-degree murder, you have to kill a human being. And what Margaret Garner killed was an enslaved child. So Margaret Garner, her husband, and her three sons were returned to their owners to live out the rest of the Civil War.
And we are still dealing with this debate. 57% of Americans saying that Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride. Well, let's remember, that flag disappeared until 1948, and who brought it back? Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrat Party. And what was their platform? We stand for segregation of the races. They knew what this flag stood for.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war. That was not the cause of the Southern states seceding. That was not the cause of the first shot being fired on that fort over there. It was about money. And it was not about slavery. It was about moral terrorists. It was about more money. Lincoln wanted to impose 45% more taxes on the southern states.
Taxes on the goods the southern states were producing. And those goods were essentially cotton, tobacco, and rice.
Slavery had nothing to do.
And those goods were produced by slave labor. All of it. Isn't that right?
I mean, the
95% of it? Isn't that right? If it's 95% produced by slave labor, enslaved people, and the North is saying, we're going to tax you on that because we want some of that money, and the South is saying, no, wait a minute, we're the ones producing it, so you shouldn't be taking the money, that money wouldn't exist without slave labor. I mean, that did affect the bottom line. Wouldn't you agree with that?
They chose to stay. In most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people treated as family? Then why wouldn't it be all right for me to own you as long as I treated you like family?
If that's the way economics work?
Would you be satisfied with that?
In today's world.
In any world.
In today's time?
In any time.
Charleston, South Carolina was the port through which almost 40% of every African-American enslaved person that came to this country came through. This is on the waterfront in Charleston, South Carolina. These men are there demonstrating every weekend, every Sunday. Cars drive by, beep horns, yell out words of encouragement, and their view is that the Civil War had nothing to do with enslaving people, and that enslaved people were treated as family. This conversation was difficult because literally the day before we had been to the Charleston Slave Mart Museum. And trust me, this is not how family was treated.
We are standing in front of the Chalmers Street entrance of the old Slave Mart Museum. This structure and this complex was created as a response to the outdoor sale of enslaved populations within the city of Charleston. By the 1850s, the outdoor sale of enslaved people that had been going on since the founding of the colony in 1670 was being seen as somewhat of an aberrant eyesore. Now, what is a large parking lot behind this building today was originally a massive pen that contained a four-story jail building utilized to house enslaved people prior to the day of sale. There was a two-story kitchen building back there for nutritional needs, as well as prepping the enslaved, and a morgue building, or more accurately, a dead house, for sick and dying enslaved. They would sell enslaved people out of this location 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. Everyone from newborns to 70-year-olds were sold out of here. For enslaved people to make the most money for the traders and for the sellers, they have to be prepped first. Prep could be everything from high-fat and high-protein diets to get them into better physical shape, as well as, you know, fresh clothing. You have the sort of prepping of the skin through oiling. If they're looking a little bit older, they could either dye the hair or pluck any grays that someone would have, things of that nature, in order to, when they come up onto the block, they're able to garner the largest amount of money.
And I'm looking at a list of Negroes,
mm-hmm.
and it says, number one, the name is Sunday, the age is 45.
Enslaved people, they didn't have last names generally until the 1870 census. And so it was the question of, what is your name?
Because the names could be changed each time you were sold?
They would be changed. That's the first thing that is changed every time you're sold. So on all broadsides you will ever see, this is just the name they come to the sale with. And keep in mind that the enslaved property of slave owners was worth more than everything else they owned. Was worth more than the plantation. It was more than the land, more than the goods that are produced on that plantation, more than the house, more than any other liveries that they have. So the first thing that's going to be sold to pay for a debt is, you know, enslaved. Because you didn't have to buy them outright. You could mortgage them. So this is representative of a pricing chart. There are four factors that define how much an enslaved person is ultimately sold for. The first is age. The younger you are, because it's a future investment, the more valuable you are. Also, there's something called prime. With enslaved individuals from about the age of 10 to 12 to the age of about 25. For males, it was the amount of work they can do in that time. They're very strong, they're very virile. And for females, it's the amount of children they can produce. And so you have the subcategories based on age, skills, health, and skin tone. And so when it came to movement of enslaved prior to being brought onto that block, they're going to be chained.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone's going to be chained. It's not just going to be grown-ups. It's not going to be the elderly. It'll also be the children.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. And again, you know, as I mentioned, that blacksmithing was a job that enslaved people would do. They could be in charge of making shackles.
Let's go upstairs. How hard is it for you to work here and do this every day? Because it has to take a toll.
It does. It does.
I get that.
Yeah. But I'm also really lucky. This is a physical aspect of control. This is the end piece of a very large whip. It was originally about 6 feet long, and if you look very closely, there are braided bits,
yes.
Nails driven into the leather wrap, and that would act as a way to both, stiffen it, but also to bite into the skin.
Easter, I would like to ask, what are the three holes that I see in these bricks in the walls there?
They're fingerprints. Enslaved people would begin to learn a skill at the age of about 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so fingerprints and handprints and thumbprints exist all throughout the city because enslaved people built the city. As you can see, my fingers don't fit because this brick was not made by it.
It was made by a child.
Yes. Yes. And so on churches, on businesses, in alleyways, you see these in theaters. You see these all throughout the city in very, very subtle ways. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you may not see them.
But they're there.
Absolutely. And they are a way of the enslaved who created this city and created the economy that created this country to remind us, hey, I was here too.
That is an example of what we are going to try and do with the time period from colonial times to the Civil War. And one of the things that Art and I were talking about earlier is that we talked about America's reaction to things like when the movie Roots came out. And when other things have come out, and America has, it seems like for a moment, looked and said, my God, that's really horrible, and then moved on. And part of it is because I think we have been insufficient in making, or we have not worked hard enough to make the connections from 1619 to 2020. And part of the purpose of this documentary is to try and make those connections, to say to people there is a direct and unbroken line from the white supremacy that let the colonial Americans get rich by bringing enslaved people from Africa to the white supremacy that exists today. And if that unbroken line can be established, I think you get people to a different place. The end of the connection to the Civil War, by 1861, remember in 1790, 1.5 million pounds of cotton a year? By 1861, it was 2.3 billion pounds a year. 60% of all U.S. exports. Folks, this is how America got rich. The number of enslaved people was now 4 million. I'm not saying, let's be clear, that America enslaved 4 million people between 1619 and 1861. It was much, much more than that. I'm saying there were 4 million alive in 1861. The value of enslaved people in 1861, $3.5 billion, more than all the money in circulation in America at the time, and worth more than $100 billion in today's money. The richest part of America, most millionaires per capita, the Mississippi Valley, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, one of the poorest places in America today because the labor of enslaved people has never been replaced in those economies. And understand, enslaved people were more than just free labor. You had to buy them, and so you take out a loan, and you had to pay interest on the loan. You had to take out insurance policies. The sales were taxed and notarized. Everybody was making this money. And so let's skip forward, because the documentary will not do the skipping. We will cover more area after the Civil War. But let's skip forward to the first half of the 20th century, and I want to talk about the Tulsa Massacre. I guarantee you, many, many, many Americans learned about the Tulsa Massacre from watching something called The Watchmen on HBO. And what I'll say that's great and bad about that, on the one hand, I can't believe it takes a cartoon movie for America to learn about one of the worst mass killings in our history. On the other hand, if that's what informed people and they now know about it, at least they now know. The Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was one of the richest neighborhoods in America in 1921. I didn't say one of the richest black neighborhoods in America. I said one of the richest neighborhoods in America. 1921, there were businesses, churches, restaurants, grocery stores, movie theaters, private airplanes. There was a hospital. There was a post office. There were schools, libraries, a law office. They even had a bus system. On May 31st, 1921, a young black man was arrested for supposedly assaulting a white woman. And you can go back and look at the newspapers, even that were written then. And at most, this young man bumped into this woman and she screamed. The narrative in the black community, of course, is that they were involved with each other and they were kissing and another white person walked into the elevator and she had to scream. At any rate, this young man was arrested and taken down to the jail. And a lynch mob was formed. But what they forgot was that the black men in the Greenwood area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had served in World War I, and they still had their long rifles, and they were trained in military efficiency. And they came down and surrounded the courthouse and kept the lynch mob out. Not one white person was injured that night. A shot was fired when there was a scuffle over a gun, a white man saying to one of the black men, "Boy, what are you going to do with that gun?" And the black man responding, "Use it if I have to." The lynch mob was turned away, and the next day, the Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned to the ground. Many people think it was a street, Black Wall Street. It was 4 square miles that were burned to the ground. And in doing our research, we came across in an old Fox Movietone file actual footage that was filmed on June 1st, 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Thank you. Pray and quiet, pray Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.